Talk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It's a Tuesday afternoon, and each and every Tuesday afternoon, Dr. Ross Walker joins us. Hello, Ross.
G'day, mate. Just seems like a week ago we were doing this.
Only 7 days. Amazing. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thanks, mate. Yourself?
Oh, not too bad, mate. Fit as a Mallee Bull, I used to say.
Well, hopefully you still are.
Fit as a Mallee Bull with one ear now. I've got a couple of listener questions for you.
Sure.
All right. Elizabeth says, I have a question for Dr. Ross. If you are on the cholesterol, is it Ezetima?
Ezetimibe.
Can you also take the K2 vitamin?
Of course you can. There's no interaction whatsoever. What vitamin K2 is, take the calcium out of your arteries, puts it back in your bones. Ezetrol blocks cholesterol absorption in the gut. So there's just absolutely no interaction between the two. And it's a good thing to take vitamin K2 if you're needing to lower your cholesterol as well.
I think I've asked you this once before. There is sprays around for vitamin D and vitamin K2 as a combination.
Yep.
Are they good, bad or indifferent?
No, they're not good because typically they only have 45 mics of K2 and the dose is 180 mics. So it's just not enough K2.
Okay.
So I much prefer to people to take it in capsule form.
Right. So you would be taking your vitamin D separately and your K2 separately.
Well, no, there are some companies who are making a combination D3 1000 with vitamin K2 180 micrograms.
Okay.
Don't have a problem with that at all. But the sprays typically have 45. Now, if anyone knows of a spray in the market that has more than 45 mics of K2, let me know, but I'm not aware of any.
All right. Thank you. Who's this from? Julie. I would appreciate if you could run this by Dr. Ross, please. Dr. Ross, what is your suggestion to best manage osteoarthritis in spine, hips and neck, please? Stiffness and pain seems to have come quite quickly over the last few months, particularly when sitting at a desk working, and how you can determine if pain is from osteoarthritis or related to a breast cancer diagnosis in 2007.
Well, it's probably not related to the breast cancer diagnosis in 2007, because unless there's any evidence of recurrence. But what I would also say, when someone has only had these sort of symptoms over the last few months, I wouldn't just assume it's osteoarthritis. You've got to make sure that it's no other inflammatory arthritis. So typical osteoarthritis is really not an inflammation. It's a degeneration in the joints, or you've got a strong family history of osteoarthritis. And so when you see older people, especially women, who've got the little lumps in their distal fingers, you know, those little lumps they get there, and they also get pain in the base of the thumb, that's typically primary generalized osteoarthritis, and that's not inflammatory. But if someone just says, look, over the last few months it's really got bad, there could be an inflammatory component. There might be an underlying rheumatoid arthritis. It could be gout. It could be some other inflammatory arthritis. So I think it's important, firstly, before you just say, I'll take this pill or take that pill or have this procedure, to go and have a workup with a rheumatologist to make sure there's no other inflammatory arthritis that needs directed therapy. Because we have now a lot of these, what we call disease-modifying agents, that can actually slow down the process. Because if you don't treat rheumatoid or the other conditions early, they can become very deforming and very debilitating. That's the first thing. Now, let's assume, just for the purposes of this discussion, it is primary osteoarthrosis or osteoarthritis. Then what I tend to say to people is that, firstly, you want to avoid taking heavy painkillers all the time because that can be bad for the body. But my favourite non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug is a drug called Celebrex or Celecoxib, 200 milligrams on the days when the pain is really causing a lot of problems. Or, for example, if someone's a golfer and plays golf twice a week, to take the Celebrex before they go to golf and they'll have a better game. That's not going to hurt you at all. Celebrex doesn't tend to irritate the stomach like Voltaren or Brufen, doesn't tend to put up the blood pressure. And in a big study where they compared all these things head-to-head in people with cardiovascular disease, it was the safest of all the drugs. But anyone listening here, I'm not suggesting that any drug is safe in any way. There's always the potential for side effects. So if you get any problems with these, you must discuss it with your doctor. And some doctors are still saying to people, oh, you shouldn't take Celebrex because it's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. So they're lumping it in with all the other drugs. But also, I believe there are some natural things that you can take which can help the pain as well. There's a new thing, or relatively new thing, called PEA. People say that's P. Well, it is, but it stands for a chemical name I won't rattle off because it's too long. But PEA has been quite effective for some people with osteoarthritic pain. There's another thing I take, and I can't actually mention the product name on air, but if people want to send an email into you, I'm happy to give you the name and where they can get it from, which is a modified polyphenol extract. And that's very good for pain as well. Standard things like krill oil, glucosamine, chondroitin, MSM preparations. The new Zolan green lip muscles is quite effective in this situation as well. And there's another proprietary drink that people advertise on certainly my radio station, and that's quite effective. So there's a whole lot of things I can say and can't say on air, but there are some natural things that do give you some assistance. And let me say, one of the best things for arthritis is exercise. So having a regular exercise habit and being assessed by a good physiotherapist who works in this space can give people help as well.
You talked about taking painkillers. Panadol Osteo, doctors told my wife this, so is this right or wrong, that you can take Panadol Osteo for a long period of time without any adverse side effects. Is that true or false?
And do you see the pig flying outside your window there? Look, all drugs have the potential for side effects. So some people might take up to 4 Panadol Osteo a day without any problems, but it can affect the liver.
Right.
And it's best to keep it to 2 a day if you're using it. It will probably not have much of an effect, but I think people should be careful about the constant use of painkillers.
This is from Marty. Marty says, this is a beauty. This is a cracker. Marty says, Dr. Ross, I was given a referral by my GP to get a coronary calcium score done.
Yep.
I then had reason to see another doctor who was a specialist in another field. He doesn't say what field that was. Happened to mention to him about the referral for the coronary calcium score. He was most concerned about the amount of radiation that this test would impart. He suggested that I just stick to the old stress test. By the way, he said, I walk about 4 to 5 kilometres a day, not short of breath or anything.
It shows you how it's interesting that people who are experts in one area think they're experts in all areas, and it's just so bizarre that in the year 2023 that a specialist would give people that sort of ridiculous advice. Firstly, let me tell you how much radiation a coronary calcium score is. It's about double what you would get sitting in front of computers at work during a year's period. So it's about 10 chest x-rays worth of radiation on the newer machine. So it's not much radiation at all. It's double what you'd get sitting in a plane from Sydney to Perth. So it's not huge radiation. Whereas if you had, say, a CT angiogram on one of the older machines, that's about 300 chest x-rays of radiation. A nuclear scan of the heart is 300 chest x-rays of radiation. So before everyone falls off their chair and says, oh, I had a nuclear scan of my heart 2 years ago, there's only 3 advantages of being over the age of 50. 1 is wisdom, 2 is grandchildren if you've got them, and 3 you lose the cancer risk from medical radiation. So don't worry about it if you're 56 and you've had a nuclear scan or you've had a CT angiogram. It's not going to cause you any major issues, but I certainly wouldn't be throwing these things around at 30-year-olds, which is why I suggest we should start coronary calcium scoring. The only 10 chest x-rays radiation, typically 45 to 50 for males, 55 to 60 for females. Less radiation.
Okay, there you go, Marty. Look, I've got more questions here on my list, but maybe we'll leave those for next week. Otherwise, we'll never get to talk about some of your topics.
Okay,
why do people gain weight? More than just lifestyle, it's more than just genes. There are new factors that are influencing excess body weight have been discovered.
Yeah, Well, this is a new study from a journal called Science Translational Medicine, which is a pretty high impact factor journal. And it's talking about what's called DNA formatting. So what they're saying is you're not changing the genes, but you're changing the epigenetics that are affecting the genes. So, for example, there's a thing called methylation sites. And a lot of people have heard the term methylation. And as we get older, many of our genes get excessively methylated, which they're using now as an aging clock. So they call it the methylation clock. And they found that in people who are overweight, often their parents or their mother during pregnancy, and the father could even pass on some of these genes as well, pass on some of these epigenetic markers, get imprinted into the child as the child's growing in utero, and can affect them gaining weight as they go through childhood and into adulthood. Because there's a lot of people, and I've just seen a man who just walked out of my office now, not walked out after he finished the consultation, because he wasn't unhappy, but he said to me, now, this guy's been a mate of mine, and he said to me, Ross, I don't get this. I work hard on my farm. He lives up at Armidale, this man. I work hard on my farm. I do all the right things. I try not to eat too much, but I'm just gaining weight. Now, and he was adopted, so we don't know what his genetics are, but what I say that life should be, if in the ideal world, is preconception to the grave. And what I mean by that is if you wanted to have children, you really should be planning 3 months of really looking after your body, not overeating, not smoking, not being stressed, not drinking too much grog, and please show me someone who does that, yeah. And then have the child, and then during the pregnancy have this idyllic, wonderful situation where the baby's growing inside a very happy, contented mother who's being loved and nurtured and looked after and eating all the right foods, and then that child is grown without all these nasty epigenetic markers when the child's born, because those epigenetic markers can then bite you on the bum as you get older and then the weight comes on. So it's just yet another layer of when we see someone who's overweight, because I see so many people like the man I've just seen, who just says, Ross, I just don't get why I'm really clapping the weight on, because I'm trying to do everything I can. So I'm saying we've got to look a bit beyond just the standard eat less food, do more exercise, which is still good information and still good advice, but it's not always the entire issue. Some people are just naturally thin. Some people just find it very easy to put on weight. If all of us went on one of those stupid survivor programs where they just don't have the access to the food that we have, well, of course, everyone would lose weight. But it's very difficult in our society to do that. And I'm saying these are just giving us more information about certain things we'll be able to do in the relatively near future to affect not just genetics, but also epigenetics.
Well, so what do you say to the patient that says, look, I eat healthy, I don't eat too much, I have an active lifestyle, but I'm still putting on weight, what can I do? What do you say to that person?
Well, what I say to them first, let's make sure there's nothing else going on. So I'm checking his male hormone status, his testosterone, his free testosterone, DHEA, etc. I'm also checking his thyroid levels, because he might have an underactive thyroid, cortisone levels, because if you're incredibly stressed, your cortisol may be high, or you may even have an adrenal tumor that's producing too much cortisone. There's a thing called a prolactinoma that can do this as well. So just, and look, that's 1-2% of people are overweight, but just to exclude that as a possibility, then I say, okay, you've got to really put an extra effort into your lifestyle. If that's not working, maybe we need to consider Ozempic, because he's starting to become a diabetic as well, and man, is now 55.
Uh-huh. So, the man who's now 55 who is struggling and putting on weight, has that person or are those people, those type of people, have they always struggled with weight?
Yeah, typically, because you see, these people, a third of Caucasians, 50% of Asians, 100% of people with darker or olive skin, carry the gene for insulin resistance.
Right.
Now, if you've got the gene for insulin resistance, it's so much easier to put on fat around the belly, to become diabetic, your blood pressure drives up, up goes your triglycerides, down the HDL cholesterol, and all of these things are associated with cardiovascular disease, obesity-related cancers, fatty liver, gout, and for women, polycystic ovaries. So it's as I say all the time, every condition is genetic, but it's your genes that loads the gun, your environment that pulls the trigger.
There's a new biomarker for depression. This is a study that's come out of Korea.
Yeah, this is really interesting, because you see, Why do we need to know a test that confirms someone's depressed or not? Because it will direct therapy. So this is for a major depressive disorder. So we're not talking about somebody who just feels a bit down. We're talking about somebody who has severe entrenched symptoms of depression, which are, firstly, you lose interest in life. That's an important one. Secondly, you're tired all the time. Thirdly, you wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning staring at the ceiling for an hour or so. When it gets to the point of very severe, you have a sense of hopelessness about your life and even suicidal thoughts. Now, it's really important to distinguish between that major depressive disorder and somebody who is suffering grief. So, for example, someone walks into a doctor, they can't stand their partner, they hate their job, their kids are on drugs, their life's a mess, and they go, "Doctor, I'm so depressed." Yes, they're depressed, but they're depressed because they're grieving about the losses in their life. That is not a major depressive disorder. They need different therapy than does the person with the major depressive disorder. So what they've done is do a particular sort of MRI scanning where they're looking at this thing called, love this word, the local gyrification index of the cortex of the brain. So the outside of the brain, the thinking part of the brain, is called the cortex, and they can measure how folded that is. If it's underfolded, that's a marker for this major depressive disorder. So it's interesting that things that happen in your life, such as developing the disease depression, can actually change the brain structure and how the brain looks on an MRI. So it could be at some stage in the near future that we're using this LGI or local gyrification index as an indication for a major depressive disorder.
I was just thinking about someone going to a GP and having a conversation with a GP, and it seems as though there are so many diagnoses of people suffering from depression these days, and they're getting that from their GP, and the GP is giving them a prescription for antidepressants and all these sort of things. It just seems as though it's forever on the increase, this diagnosis of depression.
Oh, yeah, and it's one of the most commonly used drugs on the planet, which are antidepressants. And it's because a lot of the times people aren't suffering depression, and I'm not saying they don't need help. I'm just saying they're not going to respond as well to the antidepressants as do people with a major depressive disorder.
Talk about COVID-19. There are studies that have demonstrated that at least 20% of people infected with COVID-19, as in the SARS-CoV-2, remain asymptomatic. In other words, they've got it, but they don't really show any signs of having it.
Yeah, and this is really interesting because you've probably spoken to people like this who almost see it as a badge of honour.
They do, don't they?
They go, "Oh, I got COVID. It was nothing. Didn't do anything to me at all. All this COVID stuff's overdone." And it shows you how narcissistic and narrow-minded people are, because the world's all about them.
Yes.
And we're looking at a group of people here, and this was a study of 30,000 individuals, of whom just under 1,500 were unvaccinated. But they found that of the ones who were unvaccinated who were exposed to COVID, 20% had no symptoms at all. So, and what they're saying is that there's a particular marker in the blood called HLA markers, which we all have, and they're markers just to tell us that this cell is a human cell as opposed to a bacterial cell or some other foreign toxin. And these HLA markers are very important. So there's an HLA marker called B15, which is pretty common, and they found that of the people who are asymptomatic with COVID, 20% were HLA B15 positive, as opposed to 9% who were actually sick with COVID. So it gives you a double the benefit against getting COVID. So there's another, to give you an example, there's a thing called being HLA B27 positive, as opposed to HLA B15 positive. If you're HLA B27 positive, you have a much higher risk of getting conditions like ankylosing spondylitis, Reiter's syndrome, all of the arthritic problems people get with inflammatory bowel disease. So these things are important markers, but it's just allowing us to understand why some people get sick with some infection and other people don't get as sick with the infection. I'll give you an example. My immune system loves influenza. I hate it because if I don't have a flu vaccine every year, I come down like a ton of bricks from influenza. Whereas I've got one of my best friends is a 90-year-old Jesuit priest, and he has never had a flu vaccine in his life and has never had influenza. And I've had it about 10 times. So it's just my immune system is very susceptible, whereas his isn't.
Amazing, isn't it? As you probably know, because I think we were texting each other at the time, I eventually succumbed to COVID-19. Until then, I love this. I never heard of it before, but I was a novid. There's a name for everything these days, isn't there? I was a novid until I got COVID. And, and I lost my sense of smell and sense of taste. Yep. Yep. And I got to tell you, I lost it for about 2 weeks. And I remember one particular weekend, we were somewhere and my wife said, let's buy some fish and chips. So we went and we bought some fish and chips. And with the fish and chips, there was lemon in the fish and chips. And I couldn't smell anything. I couldn't taste anything. And I said to my wife, give me the lemon. And I sucked on the lemon. And honestly, I could not taste a thing. Absolutely nothing. That was scary.
Yeah, well, can I tell you, that's one of the things that happens with it, but there's a thing called photobiomodulation, which can actually improve the taste. If people are having ongoing problems with taste, this may help them. It's just a simple local laser technique around the face that can help. But with COVID, I've had COVID twice that I'm aware of.
Right.
Didn't have any problems with my sense of smell or taste, but when COVID first came out in early 2020, I had some Chinese friends I had dinner with, and they'd isolated after 2 weeks of coming back from China. A few days after that, I lost my sense of taste before anyone was even talking about that being a symptom of COVID, and I felt sick for a week, and red wine tasted like vinegar. I of course pushed through that, but it was just weird that I said, why on earth have I lost my sense of taste? Maybe I had one of the earliest cases of COVID.
Maybe you
got
did.
Over it in a week. Yeah.
I've got to go. I bet you've got to go. So thank you, mate. As always, we'll look forward to catching up with you next Tuesday.
Good on you, mate. Love it.
Thanks, Ross. See you, mate. Bye-bye. That is Dr. Ross Walker.